Hello and welcome to episode 15 of Two Chairs Talking, the podcast where we talk about the books we've been reading, the movies we've been seeing, and absolutely anything else we find interesting. Later on in this episode, we'll include a short interview I did a little while ago with Daniel Scott White, who lives in Taiwan and who's been successfully editing and publishing a series of science fiction and fantasy magazines over the last few years and seems to be doing very well with that. My name's David Grigg, and my co-host is Perry Middlemiss. How's things, Perry?
Pretty good, thanks, David. Pretty good indeed.
You sound like you've got a little bit of a cold.
Oh, it's this weather. God.
It's hot and cold, isn't it?
There's actually a piece in Today's Age about iconic Melbourne songs. And the classic one that we all remember, of course, is Crowded House's Four Seasons in One Day.
Yes.
Normally you get that in Melbourne. Lately we've just had one and it's been winter and yes. It's supposed to be moving from spring into summer and it's like 12 or 14 degrees. It's just terrible.
Yeah, it's not good. It's not good for the health. I know. I've thrown off a bad cold.
I just think it's something either like molds or just pollen. I think my sinuses have just given up. They can't work out what season it is. And so if I sniffle a little bit too much, my apologies to our listener.
all one of you. Now, there are
all
more
one of them.
There are more than one of us.
That's good.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So we're going to run our little funny little Hugo time machine segment shortly. But first, I wanted to pick up on a couple of corrections to what we've said in the past. We said last episode, I think, that we don't do real-time fact-checking, and that's fair enough, but it's when we do make fairly big mistakes, we do appreciate it when people come back to us and say, you got that wrong, so we should acknowledge that that we have made a couple of mistakes. So I'll start by saying thanks to an alert listener who let us know that we were wrong when we were talking in our AussieCon episodes and said that the Hugo Award rocket ships were made by Pete Weston for the 1975 convention. That's quite wrong. In fact, he didn't start making them until 1984. And so we must have been thinking about AussieCon 2, in which case he would have made them for that. And the same listener reminded us that the early awards weren't called Hugos. They were called the Science Fiction Achievement Awards. And Hugo was a sort of casual designation that only became attached to the awards a few years later. Presumably, that's in imitation of the Oscars. It was in imitation of the Oscars. The name wasn't formally changed to be formally the Hugo Award for them all until 1993. But we have been calling them the Hugos since about 1957 or 58, I think. Anyway, so
What I think this comes down to, David, is basically that if anybody is going to use this particular podcast as a reference for their PhD,
probably
best to check with us first.
Not even as bad as using Wikipedia.
No. Don't go dissing Wikipedia. I've done a fair bit of work there over the years, and no, they're pretty good.
What I was trying to say is that Wikipedia is much more likely to be right than we are.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, fair enough. I'll give you that.
Yeah. All right, now on to
the Hugo Time Machine.
Now, Perry, 1957 was an interesting year in terms of the Hugos.
Yes, it was. This is 1957. The Worldcon was held in London. There were basically only awards for Best American Professional Magazine, Best British Professional Magazine, and Best Fan Magazine, and that was it.
Yep.
There weren't any fiction awards given out at all. And there might be a little bit of a reason for that, which I'll come to in a minute. But the Best American Professional Magazine was given to Astounding, edited by John W. Campbell Jr., unsurprising.
He seemed to get a lot of them.
Yeah, and I'll give you a bit more information about that just in a minute as well. The Best British was New Worlds, edited by John Carnell.
Yep.
And the Best Fan Magazine was Science Fiction Times, edited by James Terracey, Ray Van Houten, and Frank R. Prieto Jr., beating out, of all things, Inside by Ron Smith, who I think migrated to Australia later on.
And
Hyphen, edited by Walt Willis and Chuck Harris. Hyphen. It beat Hyphen. Walt Willis is famous as a fan writer, probably one of the top handful ever. And he's from Ireland, produced Hyphen, and everybody says he was robbed. To be frankly, I've never heard of Science Fiction Times, and nor have I heard of any of the three editors of it. But I've certainly heard of Walt Willis and Chuck Harris, and I've heard of Ron Smith. So that's a bit strange. So anyways, these things happen, and you basically get to the point where sometimes various weird things occur. So anyway, now there's a bit of a rumour, and it's only a rumour, which I've read about, which has been stated by Rich Horton, who's a editor in the science fiction field, produces one of the best SF of the year collections. And he says that the reason why there were no fiction categories included was to protect the British-administered International Fantasy Award from competition.
Ah, interesting.
And the International Fantasy Award was set up, and I don't know how long it ran for, but it basically petered out after that particular year because it pretty much died. I think that the International Fantasy Award was given to Lord of the Rings, and that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to be that the British fans or the British committee organising the Worldcon had just decided that they weren't going to give any fiction awards that year, and purely and simply gave it out to magazines, which is all a bit strange. But it's interesting to go and have a look at what sort of material was published in those two magazines for the year of 1956. And I've got a copy, an old copy, which I hold up to the camera, so you can read it now. Listener probably can't.
Listener can't
see it. Yes, well, it says index. It's the MIT Science Fiction Society's index to the SF magazines 1951 to 1965, compiled and copyright 1966 by Ed Irwin Strauss. And if you were to look closely, David, you could see that it's got some punch cards on the very front cover.
So it does, yes.
And on the inside, it is basically a printed version of a computer printout, which, well, at least it's hardbound, and I've got it, and I've probably had this for like 40 years. But it's interesting to have a look and see what sort of material was published. Now, Astounding Science Fiction in 1956 was monthly. I could only find two serials published in the magazine in 56. One was Double Star by Robert A. Heinlein, which we discussed last time.
Last time we did the Hugo things, yeah, because it won the best novel, yeah.
Yep, that's right. And the other one was The Naked Sun by Isaac Asimov.
Yeah.
Now, that's the, I believe rightly, Naked Sun is the sequel to The Caves of Steel.
It is, yes.
Yes, so that's in these robot detective series.
Yep.
So those two. They're the only two that I believe were there. Now, in the magazine that year for short fiction, you have extra material by people such as Asimov, Leinster, Eric Frank Russell, Budrus, Silverberg, Paul Anderson, Randall Garrett, James Gunn, and Hal Clement.
Clement.
Now, as you can tell, it's classic old white guy stuff. They probably weren't old white guy stuff. At that time, they were young white guy stuff, but they were still young white guys. I couldn't recognise any women's names there. Now, there may have been some who were being published under pseudonyms. The classic pseudonym, of course, was just putting in the initials. And unless you check every single one of them, you're not really going to know. But I don't really think very much was published by women in Astounding Science Fiction in 1956. New Worlds, on the other hand, and this is interesting because Astounding was mostly American, Russell, of course, being British, as I've had pointed out to me. New Worlds published mostly UK and Irish writers. So you have Brunner, James White, who was Irish, Brian Aldiss, Ken Bulmer, Sturgeon, Ballard and Azimov snuck in there at the end. But the interesting thing in New Worlds is there was one story by Frank Brining, Australian SF author,
and
one by Norma Hemming, another Australian SF author. Although she was born in the UK, she'd migrated in about probably the 40s, I think. She was born earlier than that, migrated to Australia in the 40s. So in 56, she was based in Australia when she sold this story to John Carnell at New Worlds. So she was based in Australia when she sold that. And now, of course, there's an award given out each year at the Australian National Science Fiction Award called the N.K. Hemming Award for diversity. That's interesting. Two serials that I found in New Worlds in 1956. The first one, Who Speaks of Conquest by Lan Wright. Never heard of him. And Tourist Planet by James White. Now, I thought I'd never heard of that book. It's also been published and also known as The Secret Visitors, but I don't know it under either title. But I do know about Double Star and The Naked Sun. So that's interesting. It's interesting that there was that difference in the nationalities and also the diversity of the two publications. But that's where it came from. That's where it got to.
Indeed. So, that was interesting. That commission, I think I'm right in saying that was the first one held outside North America. There'd been one in Canada, but I think this was the first outside North American continent.
Yeah, you're probably right.
That's interesting. I think John W. Campbell was guest of honour too. I think I'm correct in saying that. That must have been quite an interesting convention to go to.
It would have been.
All right. So we wanted to talk about a movie which came out 40 years ago. So it's the anniversary of the movie coming out. And of course, that film is Alien, directed by Ridley Scott. And it was unique in many ways. I first saw this in 1979 when it first came out. We had been at the World Science Fiction Convention in Brighton, which was SeaCon 79. And on the way, and there'd been quite a lot of talk about the movie Alien at the convention. There'd been a panel, and some of the people who'd made the movie were talking about it. And so we were quite interested. And then on the way home from London, we had to wait for quite a while for our plane. Before we had to go out to the airport to catch our plane. And so we thought, the movie's on at this cinema near us where we are. We'll just go in and watch it. And we did and enjoyed it. But then, of course, on the way home, we're sort of lying there unable to sleep with all these horrific images rattling around our brains. So that wasn't exactly a great experience. But nevertheless, I actually think Alien is an extremely good film. There's certainly things wrong with it. I'm sure that Perry will point out some things that are wrong with it. I personally think the things wrong with it are to do with the horror element to it. Which sort of falls down a bit,
No, I have to really disagree with you there. You put your point, and then I'll basically tell you where you're wrong.
That's absolutely fine. Yeah, I mean it's a fine horror movie it's a suspense movie from that point of view, but I just think it's a beautiful piece of science fiction. What can I say about it? It's got some terrific set design. The spaceship that they're in, the Nostromo, a lot of the internal signage, I think, was devised by Ron Cobb. Clever iconography, really nice sort of look to the interior of the spacecraft. And, of course, the alien spacecraft, where the designs were drawn from paintings by H.R. Giger, which really has this really strange, alien, creepy sort of feel. And so I think that they're really great features of the movie. The other thing I liked about the movie is how slow it is. The pace of the movie at the start is incredibly slow. You start off and you get the interior of the spacecraft Nostromo, and it's all silent. You hear a little bit of noise, there's just a few little things happening, but it's all just machine noise and so on. There's no one speaking. and there's very little movement. So a little bit of movement, which occasionally surprises you. You know, there's a little bit, a little toy bird that dips its beak into a glass of water. You might remember those things. There's little bits of movement, or a display reflected in a helmet. That's the kind of movement. You sort of, you startle every so often by this little bit of movement. And but this, it's actually, you actually go 7 minutes into the movie. I've timed it. 7 minutes into the movie before there's a human being speaks, and that's when they all wake up from their deep sleep and then start sitting around the table and having a meal. So it has a nice pace and a nice handling of audio. I think is one of the nice things about it. But I just think it's a very, very clever movie and a very thought provoking movie. When I think it gets let down a bit is I say the kind of the horror stuff at the end is a little bit formulaic. It's the there's a monster in the house kind of thing. I see Perry disagreeing with me strongly. So Perry, you tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, let's go back to the beginning, and you said you saw it after leaving the Brighton Worldcon. I didn't go to that Brighton Worldcon, but I seem to recall seeing the film in the cinemas in its first run. And I think I must have gone to a fairly early screening in Adelaide, because I've got this feeling that I ended up somewhere down the front couple of rows.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're off to one side a little bit. But the major shock, of course, for everybody is when you get, and we don't, We can do spoilers here.
Oh,
it's 40 years old.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen this film, well, bad luck, really. I mean, you should have by now. You haven't got an education. When you get the chest burster, everybody just jumped.
Oh, yeah.
Well, straight away, because you know you thought something bad's got to happen. Oh, that was a bit of a shock.
Yeah.
I remember talking to my son, who's now 20, when he went to see it first, and I said, "Oh, I remember that. That was a really shocking part." And he just looked at me, "Oh no, you can see that coming a mile off." I go, "Yeah, well, okay." Cinematic education has come a long way since my early times, but I've actually got a friend who was working in the film industry and was living in London at the time, and he was actually wandering around Pinewood Studios at the time that this was being made.
Oh, right.
So probably late 78, early 79. And he was wandering around and he just saw this sign, Alien, production Alien, Ridley Scott. Oh, I wonder what the heck this is. So he's wandering around, had a bit of a look, and somehow he said he actually got into the into the film studio. And he said the interesting thing was the way they did the filming. That when they built the ship, that the Nostromo that the crew was on, and firstly let me say I think it was the very first time in cinema that we saw a spaceship that looked lived in.
Yes,
it had crap all over the place. There were empty coffee cups, there were bits of paper over here, there was stuff lying around. It was like somebody's, you know, at the control desk, it was like somebody's office desk. There were bits and pieces around. It looked lived in, looked completely lived in, which was really quite interesting. Bits of it were grotty, and parts of the spaceship were bits dripping down, and there was water dripping down the walls, and you think, well, an oil. And it looked visceral, and it looked correct. You know, it looked just like a spaceship you would thought should have looked, rather than the shiny, bright, gleaming things from the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so what he said was, what they had done is they'd built the whole of the Nostromo set, and in order for it to look as though it was completely contained all over the place, what they did was they cut holes in the outside and stuck the cameras through.
Yes.
And they put the cameras through in certain spots so that when they moved the camera around to another angle through another spot, they could just basically plug up that original hole with a porthole or a cabinet and put something over the top of it, so it looked like a complete and utter filled 3D set.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much the way that it was.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was very weird, very different, very interesting, but a very good science fiction film, as you say. But I will take the fact that, yes, the horror aspects of it were reasonably formulaic, But that's basically what happens in a major horror in a major horror film. You get a certain run of events that go all the way right through. The major thing that was so good about this is you don't see the monster until the very end.
Yes.
You see bits of it.
Yep.
You see a little bit of a shadow. Yep. You see the cat looking at the monster while it lifts somebody up.
Yep.
And you see the cat's eyes following it up. And that's scarier than actually seeing the whole thing first And you only get little bits of it. So the monster in the cupboard does not come out of the cupboard until right at the very end, when Ripley's in the escape pod with the cat, and then the whole thing comes out. It's wonderful. It's just tremendously, tremendously good.
Yeah, I think it's a very well made movie, and it's brilliant cinematography. I think there's some really terrific shots in there. And, and as I was talking about the sound before, there's a lot of silence in it. Right at the start, or near silence, right at the start, some of the when was it Parker? The other chap, I can't remember. He's walking around looking for the cat, and there's really no background sound. There's just the dripping sounds of the water dripping down, and all that sort of thing. And the other little episode I really like is where Ripley and Ash, the science officer, are having this furious argument, but sotto voce, because they're in the infirmary where Kane is still lying there with the horrible thing on his face. And they're really just talking really low-voiced, but Ripley is absolutely furious because Ash has let the team back into the spacecraft, breaching all the quarantine protocols. And letting them in, so she has this furious little argument, but it's really really very low key in terms of the voice level. And I think that's it's subtle in those sorts of ways.
We do find out why he's done
that.
We do,
and that's a really interesting theme, I think, throughout that, and it actually ties into what I'm calling the rest of the Ridley Scott Alien trilogy, which is Prometheus and Covenant, which we may or may not talk about today. But I just think it's a really, really nicely made movie. And, I say just a little bit at the end, I was a bit disappointed with the, you know, you've got to have the self-destruct thing going with great big numerals ticking down.
I love that. Yeah. That's fantastic.
There's always, of course, the bit where there's 30 seconds to go. Oh no, she's got to go back and get the cat or something.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a good deal more than 30 seconds elapsed before she gets the damn cat. But it's good. Yeah, it's good.
But it's all good tension building. Yeah, and is. You know, it's you look back on it and you sort of think, well, you know, maybe some of this is cliched, but maybe this was the first time the cliches were used. You know, it's one of those things, you know, it's one of those things that now they look cliched, but if you're the originator of the cliche, you never were cliched.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying this was the originator of that, but I thought they'd handled it really well. And I can still go back and suspend my disbelief enough to be able to sit there and be scared in the movie.
I can certainly still watch the movie with a great deal of enjoyment. I must have seen it 5 or 6 times by now.
Yeah,
and it's very enjoyable. The other thing we mustn't forget to say is the casting of this movie is just terrific. You've got a very limited cast. Essentially, there's 5 people plus the person who plays the alien, who doesn't have a lot to say. But the casting is brilliant. Sigourney Weaver, of course, as Ripley, is just iconic as the strong, tough woman who takes absolutely no nonsense. And
probably the first time that had happened in a science fiction film as well.
Yeah. Probably. Ian Holm as Ash, I think, is great. Tom Skerritt was okay as the captain of the ship, but wasn't all, as good as the others. But I like the sort of the little comedy duo of Parker and I forget the name of the other character, the two workmen.
One's played by Harry Dean Stanton.
Yeah. And they're terrific together. I mean, it's like
absolutely
a
wonderful
comedy team. It's really good.
Well, that's the sort of the slight comic relief, which I think is really good.
Yeah.
You know, and they keep on going on and on about wanting more bonuses all the time.
Yeah, that's
you know, right. Well, they won the workers' rights. But then you got John Hurt.
Oh, John Hurt, of course, is Kane, yeah.
Yeah, but he's basically only in there for, you know, half the movie and then he's gone.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've got some pretty damn good actors in this thing that they've plucked out. So it's good.
Yeah, I think we agree it's a great movie. But then we come to the sequel.
Aliens, yes.
Directed by James Cameron.
Yeah.
I personally think this is a terrible movie, but everyone seems to think it's terrific. So you tell me why it's terrific.
Okay, all right. I sat down and thought about these two films, Alien and Aliens, and I wrote a synopsis of the first film, and this is my brief synopsis of it. So a ragtag band of humans answers a distress call from an alien planet. After investigating, they discover they've come into contact with an alien life form that is intent on killing them all. One by one, they're picked off until only a feisty female is left. Trapped on an escape module with the alien, the human succeeds in defeating it and escapes back to Earth. And guess what? That's the same plot for both the first two films, exactly the same.
Yes.
There are differences in the way that the films are presented, of course. In the second film, it's no longer a horror film because you know what the alien looks like and you know the destructive power of it. And so what it comes to there in the second film is it's basically only an action
science fiction film. It's an action shoot-em-up movie. That's what it's it is. And that's all, the best you can say about it is that it's a shoot-em-up movie which takes some of the themes from the first movie. But that to me is like, what's wrong with it? The fact that it has no subtlety at all.
Oh, there you go. Subtlety is absolutely, it does not have any subtlety whatsoever. They did the horror in the first one, they did the guns in the second one.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not condoning the use of guns at all, but here we're talking about a fantasy. We're talking about a fantasy world to which we can just enjoy what we see on the screen without necessarily saying, well, people should have guns all over the place. We don't want that. But however, I liked the way that it was put together. I liked the way that a lot of the themes from the very first film were moved into this one. And there were just another, it's just another way of looking at the same plot, and there's a lot of the same plot devices. And I thought that was interesting. It's military science fiction, pure and simple. The horror's gone, and we're just down to that. And I thought, I thought it was okay. I enjoyed it. I can still go back and watch it and enjoy it.
I can imagine going back and watching it just for the sake of commenting about it.
Completion.
Yeah, it's not that long since I saw it. But again, the casting, other than Sigourney Weaver, who's always terrific, the casting, I think, was pretty ordinary. I mean, you've got Paul Reiser playing this businessman-type character, Burke, who basically is playing the same character as he played in the TV series Mad About You, really. I mean, it just doesn't seem to have any difference in the actual character he's playing.
He's just a bastard in this, and that's it. He's just out for the
butt. Well, he's a corporate sort of bastard, and that's about it, and gets his comeuppance, if I recall. But, so that wasn't great. So really, Sigourney Weaver is the only really good character out of it, I think. I mean, the little girl is pretty good, who plays Newt.
Oh, yeah, she's all right.
She's good.
Yep.
I just think it's a pity that it loses some of the subtlety, well, a good deal of the subtlety of the original, and isn't anywhere as thought-provoking. The first movie was thought-provoking.
Yep.
And this one is.
Yep, I agree with that.
Yeah. And I think it comes down to director and things, because I personally, and I know a lot of people disagree with me, but I personally like the Ridley Scott prequels, which are Prometheus and Alien Covenant, because to me that he's actually made them all joined together in very clever ways. You can again say that the horror parts of them are probably the weakest parts of them, but I just really like Prometheus and Covenant because of the character played by Michael Fassbender, who plays the character David, who's an android. He's the real monster.
Yeah.
You know, not the slimy alien creature. The real monster in those two movies is David, and that's a great performance, I think.
But I think the films are redeemed by the acting as opposed over the top of the script. I think there's some really bad things that are done in that script, those scripts. This is just something I choose to believe. We're talking about a scientific expedition here. Beliefs should not be coming into it. You basically should have facts, and that's it. So there was a couple of things that I groaned about, a couple of things out loud when I saw this. So, you know, the idea that the pattern they find based in the caves all around the world, that it is just pure unadulterated yeah, rubbish.
There's no way you could look at those paintings and actually work out where the hell this thing was supposed to be.
Well, even if it's, I looked at it, I thought, well, okay, so maybe it's a constellation of stars. But they specifically say, no, it's not stars, it's planets. Well, I'm sorry, but planets move.
That's right.
And, you know, stars, no, I don't get this. Even the stars move, over a period of 10,000 years. The night sky is not what it was 10,000 years ago. We've moved. The Earth and Sun have moved around the galaxy quite a fair way. And the constellations have changed.
Yeah,
so
that's all absolutely.
But to
nonsense.
Say they're planets, well, that was just nonsense. Yeah, okay, and that, okay. I groaned then.
So you lost it right at the start.
Oh, yeah. But once you start getting to that point.
But I just love this character, David, and how Fassbender plays him. It's just so clever. The fact that he's the only conscious being for a while on the spaceship, and so he's kind of bored, and he goes around on a bicycle throwing hoops and goodness knows what, and watching movies, and he watches Lawrence of Arabia and models his character on a voice on Peter O'Toole in that movie. So it's clever. There's so many clever things in it. I just like that. I like all the sort of literary allusions that Ridley Scott manages to fit into his movies. Because one of the things about the Lawrence of Arabia stuff is that half of the character David's dialogue for the next 20 minutes or so is actually quotes out of the movie, out of the Lawrence of Arabia movie. But no, you know, unless you knew that's where it's from, you go, oh yeah, well, we just said that, yeah. So it's clever, I think. And I think Covenant picks up well from that. And there's this lovely bit where they've just sort of been rescued from the aliens and taken back to David's citadel, if you like. And he says, he's talking about being stranded after the Lady Elizabeth, who accompanies him from Prometheus, she's supposed to have died in the crash of a spacecraft on this particular planet, and he sort of wistfully says, I've been alone on Crusoe on his island, and you think to yourself, it's not Robinson Crusoe's island, it's the island of Dr. Moreau, because he's been building all these horrors. He is actually the one who's been breeding these creatures. And in fact, you actually get to the point in that movie where you see that he is the one who's actually bred the most perfect organism version of these alien creatures, which start off as these kind of strange hybrids. But he's the one who has produced the perfect organism, as Ash calls him in Alien. And I love the way that all those three movies tie together in all sorts of ways. So yeah, I think that's a nice trilogy. But yeah, it's a Ridley Scott trilogy.
So would you, if you had a preferred viewing sequence, what would it be?
I think it would probably still have to start with Alien.
You're right.
But then obviously Prometheus and then Covenant. Yeah, even though that's the reverse, even that's not the chronological
reverse order.
There's maybe some doubt about exactly when the timing was, so I don't know. But yeah, I like him. So
no, it's fair enough. Yeah. Well, it's interesting when you think about it. 40 years,
yeah,
pretty amazing stuff. And then of course, just to finish off, and something that we might have to discuss in a couple of weeks, another film was produced at the end of the 1970s, early 80s, by Ridley Scott.
Yes,
set in this very month, November 2019.
Yeah, indeed, which is Blade Runner.
In Blade Runner. So,
which has,
I mean, when
many
you think
of
about
the same themes, many of the same themes. The whole business of the android who or the androids who have been created by man but resent their creators. You know, there's a lot of commonality of themes in there, even though they're not certainly not in the same timeline.
I have seen things you could not imagine.
Yes, it's like Ridley Scott has.
Look, I think he was on a really, really big role then.
Yeah, he was.
I know that he sort of came out of nowhere because the only film that I know that he had done prior to that was The Duelists, which I've seen with Harvey Keitel and one of the Carradine brothers, I think. Have you ever seen that
one? No, I haven't actually.
It's set during the Napoleonic Wars where two French officers are gradually following each other up the ranks as they move up inside the army, and they hate each other's guts. And every time they meet each other, they always are at loggerheads, and they end up fighting duels that over the period always seem to get interrupted by something, or they're not allowed to because one of them is a little bit further up than the other one. It's been promoted higher, and you're not allowed to basically have a fight with a higher level. So they have to wait until they get to the same level, and then have a duel. It's wonderful. It is really,
I must look that up.
Beautiful to look at.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic to look at. And if there's nothing else, Ridley Scott makes films that are a feast for the eyes, that are excellent to look at.
Absolutely.
There's always stuff in the background that you can keep an eye on that look really, really good.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's very true. Yeah, no, he's a great director.
David, a couple of episodes back, I mentioned that I had been reading a few large volumes, bricks, I referred to them as.
You did.
And one of them is the latest George R. R. Martin book.
Oh, you're telling me that Winds of Winter is out?
No, no. No, steady on. No, this is. I would actually think that you would find this as a writer to be quite an interesting exercise. Although, so let me explain. So, as you know, Martin's book *Song of Fire and Ice* which was made into the television series *Game of Thrones*, and the TV series takes its title from the first volume in the sequence. Originally, that first sequence was going to be three novels, then it got out to five, and now it's out to seven, of which five have been written. And we're all waiting with not so much bated breath, because I think we've given up holding our breath for it. We know it's going to... We would have turned blue by now. Look, he doesn't owe us anything. It's up to him to get it out when he gets it out. We just hope that he does get it out. I'm hopeful. Anyway, so... Martin has built this fantasy world based around the continent of Westeros, which is western continent. And he has gone to very great lengths to build up the whole history of this particular country, all of its kings, all of its queens, all of the history. And if you go back and have a look at everything that's out there on the internet, you could find a big Game of Thrones or Song of Fire and Ice wiki, which is basically like a big encyclopedia about everything to do with this particular fantasy creation of George Martin's. Now, going back to the Song of Fire and Ice, if you recall, now you have read the first couple of books, haven't you?
I've read them all the ones that have been printed.
All right, okay. So, and as you will recall, the TV series and the first book takes off some way into the reign of Robert Baratheon in about, what year was it? In about the year... 280 AC, and I'll explain what that means in a minute, Robert and Ned Stark raised a rebellion, called Robert's Rebellion, against the sitting king at the time, the Mad King, and overthrew him. The king was killed, and Robert became king of Westeros, of the Seven Kingdoms. That was in 280. The first season of Game of Thrones starts in 298. And then, interestingly, each season, although it doesn't actually state this clearly, I don't believe, in the TV series, each series covers another year. So each year is another series in the TV series. So we go through basically from 298 through to about 305, 306. Now, I need to be able to tell you what the numbering is, because, of course, this is a specific new world and a new chronology that Martin's got together. The numbering comes through from the AC stands for after the conquest. Aegon Targaryen had decided, for a number of reasons, to take over the Seven Kingdoms, to basically conquer the whole lot of them. He had three dragons, two sister wives. As you're going to, you imagine, there's a fair amount of incest that goes on in these novels. This is a fairly standard and common thing that has happened in histories in the past. The pharaohs of Egypt used to marry their sisters or half-sisters purely to try and keep the bloodlines pure. But of course, as we all know, that leads to genetic mutations and lots of problems with some of the kids. Anyway, in this instance, Aegon Targaryen conquers the Seven Kingdoms of Westeros with three dragons, two sister wives who basically fly on dragons as well. This takes 2 or 3 years. And there's an interesting little point that Martin makes, that the historians actually got the date wrong. It's a bit like, you know, the date of Christ. Everybody thinks that Christ was born in sort of the year dot, you know, was zero, which there wasn't. But now people have basically come to the conclusion that he was born either in 3 BC or 6 AD, somewhere in that area.
There's consensus is it's about, 3 or 4 BC.
3 or 4 BC. So we're basically, they got the dates wrong. So this is a bit of a nod to that. And there's a bit of a, Martin's made a bit of a joke about that as well. So the book that I'm basically here to talk about is a book that Martin has got together because he's built up this huge history and he's written it all up all over the place. And he's basically got all of this stuff together. It's allowed him to be able to put little bits of the history into the novels that he's writing in the Song of Fire and Ice sequence, and that also appear in the TV series, where people allude back to, oh, this happened and this particular dragon skull was this particular dragon that did this, and this happened to the Mad King, and don't forget that this guy married his sister in this year. So all of the characters can basically allude back to all the history, and it fills out the whole of the view of that world that you're looking at, to give you the impression that it's been there a long time. It isn't just an artifice that's been just thrown up purely and simply for the TV series just to run with that and then be thrown away. It's been running for 300 or 400 years. And in fact, if you go back into the wikis and have a bit of a look at it, you realise that way back, he takes the history back to 16,000 years ago. Now, it's not in a lot of detail back there, but he has got a lot of detail from the year one up until Robert's Rebellion. And the book that I'm about to talk about, Fire and Blood, which was released at the end of 2018, I believe, is his written history of the first part of the Targaryen kings. That is from around about the year one up to around about 150. And the book is called Fire and Blood, Being a History of the Targaryen Kings of Westeros, Volume 1.
Oh, God.
From Aegon I, the Conqueror, to the Regency of Aegon III, the Dragonbane, by Archmaster Maester Glyldane of the Citadel of Old Tyrion, here transcribed by George R. R. Martin. Oh, the joke is that he's just writing the history up. But this is 700 pages of the history of Westeros from the year one up until the year 150. Most people that are going to be reading the books or watching the TV series really are not going to have a lot of interest in this. But those that are invested in the whole of that world are going to really enjoy it. It reads like a history. So in a lot of ways, it's fairly dry. There's a lot of he did this, he did that, he did this. But Martin, above all else, is a pretty good storyteller. He tells good stories and he writes well. And so there is a lot of dramatic impact in this particular book. Now, one of the reasons why I decided to pick it up is, you know, being completist as we are as science fiction fans, which is a problem that most of us have. I wanted to basically get through it and read it to sort of see what was going on. And I also had heard that there were two prequel TV series being developed.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was set 5,000 years before Game of Thrones. I've just heard this week that even though the pilot was filmed with Naomi Watts, the Australian actress Naomi Watts, in the one of the starring roles, that season, that's been canned.
Yep.
It's now not going ahead. But there's a second prequel, which has already started filming, has been given the green light, and it is based on this particular book. So it is taking from the very start of Aegon's conquest of Westeros and probably following all the way right through. Now, I don't think they're going to do 1 year per season, David, because otherwise they're going to take 300 seasons to get there. But to get to right up to where Game of Thrones starts, but I think they basically have a lot of good material here that it can be fleshed out. Now, a lot of people have complained about the fact that, yes, he's given us a really big book in the sequence, but George hasn't finished the book that all of us want. Well, that's up to George.
This is
his world. We're basically there visiting and waiting to see what happens. If he wants to basically finish it or even not finish it, that's his prerogative. He can do whatever he wants.
Yeah.
But this is not a book for everybody. I think it's an important book for this particular fantasy sequence. If you like, it's Martin's Silmarillion.
Yes.
It gives the first half of his Silmarillion. In essence, then, what you're going to end up getting is a history of 280, 300 years leading up to where Game of Thrones starts. It's going to be in two volumes, and it's going to be 1,400 to 1,500 pages.
Yeah.
So if you've got the stamina, get into it.
Yeah, no, not for me, I don't think. I never read the Silmarillion either, so I'm happy to read the sort of the upfront dramatic works, but not so interested in the deep background, which I understand it will appeal to some people, but it doesn't appeal to me.
It starts off dry and then slowly gets a lot more things going on, and he basically actually dramatizes whole sequences, so you can see, you know, 30 or 40 pages about what's actually happening in a particular pivotal instance or event in the history of Westeros, and that actually fleshes it out quite well. For lovers of George's work, for Song of Fire and Ice, this is pretty much a must. For others, yeah, you can take it or leave it.
Yeah,
it's up to you.
I think I'll probably leave it.
Okay.
All right. Okay, we without going into detail about what I've been reading recently, because I think that'll have to be left to another episode, I just wanted to expand on my comment, my throw-off comment last time that I wasn't quite sure that the Hugos and Nebulas were really identifying the best in the field of science fiction and fantasy. But I think that wasn't really quite what I meant to say. It certainly isn't quite what I mean. So after some thought, it's really all about my own tastes, of course. No one can set universal standards for these things. And for me, I just don't find that the Hugo Awards really haven't really been much of a guide to what I'm going to enjoy reading. I know that people like Perry very heroically read every nominee for the Hugos, but I couldn't do that because I'm just not that much interested in the kind of works that seem to be nominated and win the top awards. I mean, a few of them I've read over the last 10 years. I've read a few of the winners, but only like four, I think, three or four out of the 10 of the last 10 years. So, but really the speculative fiction that I've enjoyed reading over the last 10 years or so hasn't even been nominated for these awards. And I think that's probably just because there are probably a number of reasons for it. But I guess for me, I don't much like fantasy as such, or just plain fantasy, with very few exceptions. So that's, you know, a lot of the things that seem to have won awards are fantasy or science fantasy rather than science fiction or speculative fiction. I don't know. I suppose fantasy is speculative fiction. But anyway, I also don't much like very far out science fiction, you know, books that are set millions of years in the future or with very alienate protagonists who live on the surface of a neutron star or who have got 15 tentacles coming out of their heads or whatever. I think the reason I find such settings difficult to swallow is that so often the characters in such works seem to talk and think like modern-day white Americans. But perhaps that's just a failure of my imagination. So I just wanted to mention a few books which I'm thinking about when I think of speculative fiction I really enjoyed and haven't actually been nominated for the Hugos. Some of them I think have won things like the Arthur C. Clarke Award or the authors have been nominated for what was the John W. Campbell Award, but or maybe have won the British Science Fiction Awards. I haven't done enough research to say that. But just some examples. One was Naomi Alderman's book, The Power, which I talked about on the podcast early on, which I thought was a terrific book, which is definitely speculative fiction, science fiction, really, because it involves a new organ of electrical power being evolved for women. A book called The Wanderers by someone called Megan Howry. I'm not sure whether you know of that Perry,
no,
but
don't know that one.
That's very interesting. It's about a team being prepared to go on a mission to Mars, being the first to be the first mission to Mars. But before they go, they're all put together into a simulation. One of these things where they're all locked away for however many months they would be on board the spacecraft to get to Mars, and just to see how the relationships work with the people inside. But then there's a sort of twist to it, which is really quite interesting, which I won't give away. But you really focus on the characters and how they react to the situation and their relationship between the characters. But it's a very interesting book, which absolutely has a science fictional premise. But it certainly, I don't think, would ever be nominated for something like the Hugos. Very good book from a few years ago, which I think did win something like the author won Best New Writer Award, which was Evelyn St. John Mandel's Station 11. You familiar with that? That's a very good
book. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, post-apocalyptic book. Haruki Murakami's book, 1Q84, which is a huge book. Very interesting. It's sort of a parallel universe, or parallel timeline kind of story, set in Japan, set in Tokyo. Very interesting. I can't possibly go into the details now without more preparation, but that's definitely a work of speculative fiction and very interesting. Even things like Kate Atkinson's Life After Life, I did mention this when I was talking about Kate Atkinson, where you're following this particular character who keeps dying and she keeps being reborn, and you follow on her life through different parts of the early 20th century. And one I've just finished, which I think is terrific, both Perry and I both think this is a terrific book, but we'll talk about this in another episode, and that's a book by Claire North called The First 15 Lives of Harry August, which has a
great title.
Yeah, great title.
Great title.
Brilliant premise, which I think I can afford to give away. The premise is that people live their lives, certain people live their lives, die, and then they wake up as a child again with all their memories. And so they cycle through and their lives again and again. Very interesting premise, but then it becomes really quite a clever, almost like a thriller as well.
It becomes
very
sinister, doesn't it?
Oh, very sinister. It's a great book. We will spend time talking about it in a future episode. The other things I wanted to talk about were a couple of books which were self-published or published first online, or a series of books, I should say, were published online first. Now, there doesn't seem to be a place for awarding those kinds of books which aren't produced traditionally. I'm thinking, of course, of Andy Weir's The Martian, which was originally self-published, and therefore was never nominated for an award because it never became actually eligible, I think.
I'm not sure about that. I think, wasn't Becky Chambers' first book self-published, and that was nominated?
Okay.
Long way to a Small Angry Planet. Another good title.
Sure. Well, I suppose part of the issue is that some of these things, I think Andy Weir published The Martian originally in a sequence online, a series of blog posts. So
I think so.
It becomes tricky to work out whether they're eligible or not. And the same, I'm thinking similarly of Hugh Howey's Silo series, which were self-published from 2011 onwards, in little pieces, I think, and eventually were only eventually sort of put together into what you call novels.
I'm aware that the Hugo administrators allow for the fact that a particular book may be published in a small market, say Australia or India. I don't know, India is a big market, but in terms of the science fiction world, it's smallish. That if the book is not readily available to Worldcon attendees or voters for the Hugos, that it is possible for that book to be nominated when it does become available. So, for example, James Bradley's book Clade, I nominated it when it was first published in Australia. And when it was first published in Australia, it appeared on the Locust recommended reading list. But it wasn't published in the US for 2 years. Uh-huh. So 2 years later, it then was possible for it to be re-nominated. So I nominated it again and still didn't get on the ballot, but there we go.
So that's interesting. So if something was published, as you're saying that something was published in a small market initially, but then published in the larger market, particularly the US, then it can become eligible even though it wasn't initially.
Yes, I believe so. I think, and don't quote me on this, again, we're not trying to give people references for PhDs, but I believe that it is possible for these books to be considered separately. It's not an automatic assumption that it can be nominated in the year that it becomes readily available in the Northern Hemisphere, but I know that it has happened on a number of occasions, and that the Hugo administrators have ruled on a number of these over the time.
Oh, that's interesting. That's very interesting. Anyway, I just thought I wanted to mention those and query the issue of how those, because this is going to be an increasingly common thing, I think, of people yes. self-publishing or publishing in a sequence online, and it becomes, I suppose, a bit messy in terms of how awards are given. Anyway, really all I'm trying to say is that I thought all those were great books, and there's a few I haven't even mentioned, which really interesting speculative fiction books, which don't seem to get anywhere near the awards. And it's probably just as a matter of my taste. I like books like this, whereas I don't really like the sort of far-flung stuff, and I don't much like the fantasy books. So that's me.
All right. Okay. I'm certain that we can discuss this further down the track.
We
David.
Can indeed. And one episode, we must talk about the Claire North book, because I thought that was terrific. I've only just finished reading it, and I think it was great.
Okay, put it on the list.
Indeed. All right, well, we might leave it at that, and we'll go into the interview I did with Daniel Scott White. I'm talking with Daniel Scott White, who's a writer and magazine publisher living in Taiwan. I started off by asking Daniel a little bit about his background.
I was born in America, grew up around Chicago. Within 90 miles of Chicago. Chicago's a pretty big area. Small town, wasn't even on the map. Parents didn't let me have a TV. And so I read a lot of books.
Yeah. That's a bit mean, not letting you have a TV. We try to control our grandchildren by only allowing them a certain amount of screen time, but this seems a bit severe for when you were growing up.
Yeah. Conservative. My parents are very conservative, still are. Yeah. And my grades were pretty bad. And it was mostly because I watched TV. So one day I came home and the TV was gone. Oh. And in its place was a library card. So
okay, that works.
Yeah. unfortunately, my grades didn't go up. I spent so much time reading that I still didn't study. So it kind of backfired on my parents.
Oh, well, that's okay. All right. So when you were doing all this reading, did this give you a love of, obviously it would give you a love of books, and did it give you the impulse to want to write yourself?
Yes, it did. My mother was into writing as a hobby. She's done pretty well on her own. And so I wrote as a kid, too. I read and I wrote. I read a lot of science fiction.
Yeah.
And eventually I went on to college. Initially, I studied computer sciences. I wanted to be a gamer, you know, and write programs. And I kind of burned out on that halfway through. There was a summer where my mom did volunteer work in South America. So my father and I spent the summer playing guitar. We both decided simultaneously we were going to learn guitar. And from there, I shifted into the music business. And that's where I finished my degree in Chicago at Columbia College.
All right. So you you grew up and you read a lot of books, and you started to get the idea that you might want to be a writer. You also seem to me to have, in recent years anyway, you seem to have developed a passion for giving other people the opportunity to be published. So when did that start? What was the impulse to start helping other people get their work published?
That's a good question. I consider myself a failed writer. Well, not necessarily failed, but if you can't write, publish. Publish other people, right?
I think that's a bit unfair. Some of your stories are very good. But,
thank you.
I suppose it is that business. If you can't do, teach. But then you are.
Yeah, exactly. So I end up teaching too,
You know the next part of that, don't you? That if you can't teach, teach teachers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, or teach PE, right?
So that
reminds me of another joke. How do you make a small fortune in publishing?
I don't know. How do you make a small fortune in publishing?
You start with a large one. Yeah.
I can imagine that being
that
true.
That works out pretty good.
All right. Mm. So you had a website. You started up a website. Was that Longshot Island or was this? There was something before Longshot Island, wasn't there, that you started to and you let people get involved in putting up their own material. What was that?
I think that's when I met you.
Yeah, that's right.
You were actually one of the first members of the site, which was pretty exciting.
Yeah.
I had this idea. It was an idea, you know. It's going to be a great idea. You know how those things are. And I was going to bring writers together and make a community.
So you started off, and then you developed the idea that you wanted to publish an actual magazine. How did that happen?
The website I had put together came to a kind of natural conclusion where I couldn't see any way to develop it farther. So I went back more to the traditional route, which is create a magazine, invite submissions, and then evaluate them. And it went a lot better. It went a lot better. Yeah. And since then, it's just taken off. Instead of trying to think outside the box. The box represents the limits of what works and what doesn't when it comes to organizing people. So I went more the traditional route, and it worked really well. It worked really well at that point.
That's good. So how long have you been? You were publishing Longshot Magazine. How long ago did that start?
We ran that almost 3 years. We did 8 issues. And during that process, again, I met a lot of great people like yourself. It opened a lot of doors. It was a big growth period for me in terms of understanding the market and the authors. And again, it kind of reached a wall where I could see it wasn't going to go any farther. So, evolution to the next stage, right?
Yep.
And that's my current run of magazines, which are doing better than ever. So,
that's good. And with those, I see that you've managed to get quite a number of high-profile authors to agree to let you reprint their stories for a fee. In particular, I see that you've managed to get Orson Scott Card to give you the rights to reprint the novella version of his classic Ender's Game. That's quite a coup, I would have thought.
Yeah, I'm a bit surprised by it. When you deal with authors at that level, at the elite level, there's a certain finesse that's required. You know, you don't talk their ear off. You don't try to be their best friend.
Mm-hmm.
We've all got enough friends, I think. I think it's time to admit that. And I seem to know how to communicate with them, and I'm getting results, so I'm quite happy with it.
Yeah.
And they seem to be too. And the more of them that I work with, the better it gets. So,
yeah.
Progress. Yeah.
It seems to me with a physical magazine, you've got the whole issue of distribution, which can be a real killer for a small magazine. How did you tackle that?
Well, let's talk about Amazon. Everybody likes to talk about them. I'm tired of the compromises you have to make with these big companies. Amazon started out as the champion for the self-publisher, right? At least that's the way I saw it. And now they make the bulk of their money off traditional publishers. And I don't get the feeling they care much about the small guy. So what I've done is I publish my ebooks on Amazon, but I publish the print copies through my own channels. It's not that hard to do. You can get free software and maybe a learning curve on how to use it. I use OpenCart, which is open source. And then the other thing Amazon does is they handle the transaction. PayPal can do that for you. So you set up your own web page, you use PayPal for the transactions, and you don't have to give up such a large cut to Amazon. And it just makes sense, you know?
Yeah, that's right, if you can do it that way. So it's obviously working for you, so that's mm-hmm. terrific. So you do have a mailing list? Have you developed a mailing list that you mail out the magazine to, or do you sell it on bookstands?
Mostly through a mailing list. I have my newsletters that I send out once or twice a month, and then I have regular readers place orders through the website. And print is not a big part of the business. It was with Longshot Island. Longshot Island was almost entirely print, and I probably should have gone digital as well at that time. So I'm going back now and converting those into digital copies. But the new ventures, Unfit Magazine, Unreal Magazine, are both mostly ebook format, which is simpler for people to get access to. I thought with Longshot Island, I thought that people would want pictures. They would want a magazine format. But it's just not convenient, I think. And something you can put in your phone, your tablet, whatever, that's what works. That's what the other magazines do. So,
I followed that. Longshot Island always looked great, but mm-hmm. as you say, it's not an essential part of a fiction magazine to have illustrations in it. And so it does make sense to what you've done. You've sort of made a success of this, but in general, what do you see as the future of magazine publishing? Are magazines doomed, or do you think there is a future?
Well, I'm never going to say that print is dead, fiction is dead, science fiction is dead, but I believe the market is going through a contraction right now. We see record numbers of high-profile magazines going out of business. We see fewer people writing. We see less money available. Think of it. I'm reading a book right now. I just picked it up the other day. The book is called Platform Revolution. I'm about 20 pages in, and it's comparing Uber to Amazon to all these other kinds of platform businesses that seem to be running the world today versus the traditional businesses. One of the things platforms do is they eliminate the gatekeepers. With the traditional publisher, you've got a whole crew of editors and publishers and people who are slowing down the process versus just letting the public decide what they want. And to give Amazon credit, they allow the public to decide what should sell and what shouldn't. But think of it like this. My point of view is that the publishing industry really needs an infusion of cash. What would it take for me to get investors interested in putting money into books, magazines? And I don't have that answer yet. That's what I'm pondering these days. Think of it like this. Let's say you grow up in a cold climate like I did. I grew up in the Northwest, or actually the Midwest. It was quite cold in the winter. You turn on your car, you're going to have to wait 10 minutes for the engine to warm up before you drive it. During that 10 minutes, you're basically burning gas, burning money, and not going anywhere. Not even an inch. And yet, you have to do this before you can get the car rolling. So there's a point where you have to put money into publishing and just lose that money. Every self-published author knows you need to give away so many free copies before you can make sales.
Yes, I'm sure you're right. Well, thanks, Daniel. I think we might wind it up there. We've had a few technical problems, as you know, during the recording of this. So we'll bring this to a close. Thanks very much for being a part of this. Hope to talk to you again in future. Thanks. Bye.
Okay, David. Well, I think that basically brings us to the end of yet another little episode.
It's quite a big episode, but yes.
Well, I think it is. It covered a fair few topics, yes. And I think that was pretty good. We talk about the idea that we're going to talk about books, talk to people, and also talk about films we've been seeing. And I think we've pretty much covered all of our brief
Indeed.
In this particular episode, which is good.
Indeed.
All right.
Okay.
All done.
See
we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Indeed. See you then.
Thanks, David.
Okay, bye.
Bye.